From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The race for Florida governor is underway. We'll hear what to expect in the upcoming gubernatorial and other statewide elections, which are about a year away.
And in politics, 1 month can feel like 8 months. There's so much that can happen.
Florida rapidly expanded publicly funded school vouchers. 2 years later, money isn't always reaching students.
I thought that this school choice program was designed to help kids like her not get just overlooked.
And we'll hear from a doctor who says he has concerns about a plan from the DeSantis administration to drop the state's current vaccine mandates. I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. Although there's still about a year until the elections, Florida's capital city is already abuzz about who will run for statewide office in 2026. President Donald Trump has already endorsed Byron Donalds for governor, and questions remain about whether Trump will endorse candidates for other statewide offices. Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis seemingly has tapped his preferred heir apparent as well as his pick for state CFO and attorney general. And former Florida House Speaker Paul Renner has thrown his hat in for governor. Capitol reporter Tristan Wood sat down with the Florida Phoenix's Liv Caputo to talk about what to expect for the upcoming elections.
I know Renner filed, I believe it was last week. Walk me through his candidacy a little bit. Why is he running? What are people saying?
He thinks he's the guy for the job. He thinks he has a proven record. He described himself as having a legacy that's inseparable from DeSantis's record. He highlighted that under his leadership, the Florida legislature passed the six-week abortion ban. They banned transgender therapies for minors. You know, they got rid of DEI in higher education, all under Renner and DeSantis in that two-year period. So he thinks he has a shot. However, DeSantis says, I won't endorse you, despite that.
Yeah, I'm not supporting Paul Renner. You know, I think it was an ill-advised decision to enter the race.
So Renner's kind of in this weird third lane. You have one lane with Trump and Byron Donalds. You have another lane with DeSantis and probably Jay Collins. And then you have the third lane Renner. He doesn't have the backing of either of them. He seems to think that tensions are so ripe between the DeSantis and Trump camps that those two are just going to keep going at each other. And then Renner is going to be left there standing saying, hey, here's my Florida first message, unifying conservatives. That's kind of his strategy right now.
I know a lot of the talk earlier this year was that Casey DeSantis might run. What's happened with those rumors?
They're still floating around, but it was much louder. The rumors were much louder before Hope Florida. The scandal kind of surrounding the, you know, alleged financial situation of Hope Florida, which might be a little bit sketchy, a little bit shady to some people. So all of that tied to her kind of seemed to make those rumors that she's going to jump in get very, very quiet. Now, she still could jump in, it's true, but you're seeing Jay Collins has been elevated to lieutenant governor. He was the state senator. Now he's lieutenant governor. DeSantis, 2-3 days ago, posted a tweet of something that looked very much like an ad, a campaign ad to support Jay Collins.
So I call him the Chuck Norris of Florida politics for a reason.
Touting his record, touting how conservative he is, how DeSantis aligned he is. So it's looking like Jay Collins right now. That could always change.
You know, looking at the undercard a little bit, I know some news broke last week of conversations that people in the Trump team had with several other figures in the state of Florida to potentially run for those seats. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
There are reports saying that Daniel Perez, the House Speaker, who isn't really new to any conflict with DeSantis, that Daniel Perez might be considering a run for Florida Attorney General, which would challenge James Uthmeyer. Now, these races are a little bit more complicated than the Donald's versus probably Collins dynamic we have in that Trump DeSantis proxy war. If we take, let's take attorney general first. Say it's James Uthmeyer. Uthmeyer is a bit of an interesting case because he is trying to have an, you know, reach out an olive branch to Trump and say, hey, you know, I'm creating these things. I want to work with you, pointing to Alligator Alcatraz. We saw Trump and Uthmeyer sitting together during the opening of Alligator Alcatraz.
James Uthmeyer, where is James? Where is he? You do a very good job. I hear good things. I hear good things about you from Ron, too. Now you really do. He's even a good looking guy. That guy's got a future, huh?
What we might see with Uthmeyer is the DeSantis alignment too toxic for Team Trump? Team Trump does not like DeSantis. Is Uthmeyer going to be able to break away from that and possibly gain that Trump endorsement as well to run? If not, that's when we're going to see a Daniel Perez or maybe a different Trump-endorsed candidate challenge Uthmeyer.
You know, leading up to these races as the field's beginning to take shape, is there anything I didn't ask about that he thinks important to include or consider?
Oh, yeah, probably the fact that it's very early. And in politics, 1 month can feel like 8 months. There's so much that can happen. We are so early. It's a little bit less than a year before the Republican primary for governor, for CFO, for attorney general. So much can happen between now and then.
It was nice speaking with you, Liv. I appreciate the time.
That was WFSU's Tristan Wood speaking with Florida Phoenix reporter Liv Caputo. More than 500,000 students in Florida are using taxpayer dollars to pay for private school tuition or other educational services. The nonprofit organization tasked with distributing these state-funded vouchers to families mismanaged the money. That's according to a report by the State Auditor General. Among the findings were delayed distribution of funds and some overpayments. An influential Republican state senator offers one explanation. Florida expanded its voucher program too quickly. WLRN's Natalie LaRoche-Pietri looked into it.
As Irene and I were settling into our interview, her six-year-old daughter figured it was the perfect time for us three to have an afternoon tea party.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Can you get my tea set?
Not right now. I'll get it in a second.
Okay, I will get it. I'll be right back.
She came back with tiny mermaid teacups and a raspberry tart made of plastic. The little girl became entranced in her own world. She has autism.
She thrives the best in a setting where it's maximum 10 children. So the school that she's in now, like, complete turnaround. Like, her speech has improved so much. Her math, they're saying that she's close to third grade level in math. So it's just night and day, night and day.
The school that made such a difference in her daughter's life is private. Irene struggles to pay for the tuition on her own.
As a single parent who's trying to pay a rent that's pretty close to $2,000 a month on top of bills and then her food, she has special dietary needs. It's a lot. Like, it's a lot for any one person to deal with.
Irene planned on paying for the school with the state voucher meant for students with disabilities. Her daughter got approved for more than $10,000, but the money didn't come.
I thought that this school choice program was designed to help kids like her not get just overlooked.
Irene asked us to not use her full name or her daughter's name since she's still fighting for the funding and doesn't want to jeopardize her case. Last school year, Irene's daughter switched from a public charter school to this private school, and there was a lag in updating enrollment records. When the Florida Department of Education checked, the then-kindergartner's name came up in her old school's enrollment. The state froze the voucher to make sure her daughter didn't get funding for public and private school at the same time. Irene ended up paying most of the tuition out of pocket last year. For months, she's been emailing and calling everyone she could think of.
Just disheartening. Like, do I just give up? Do we move out of Florida? Like, how do I save to move out of Florida? Like, I want to be in a place where she can get the support that she needs, but it's just like a lot of finger pointing.
It's not a matter of finger pointing and deciding who the bad person is. It's a matter of figuring out a system that is resilient to the environment in which we're in.
State Senator Don Gates is a Republican from the Panhandle, and he's on the committee that oversees school funding. Florida's voucher program began nearly 30 years ago to help students with disabilities and those from low-income families. In 2023, state lawmakers and Governor Ron DeSantis opened the floodgates for any child to use public money for private schooling with the passage of HB 1.
In my judgment, HB 1 was done too quickly. I'm a strong supporter of school choice and parental choice, but this could have been done, I think, with a little more planning.
For most voucher programs, the money comes through the state to a nonprofit called Step Up for Students, which then doles it out to families. Step Up for Students went from servicing 258,000 students to more than 420,000 in just 4 months, and only had about 60 days to prepare. Gates pointed to a state audit that found errors in how Step Up for Students managed applications and funding during that time. Step Up for Students CEO Gretchen Schoenhar responded to the audit, saying the organization learned lessons during this, quote, unique period of historic growth and opportunity that occurred in a compressed time. However, the organization has challenged the narrative that money is not reaching the most vulnerable kids. The nonprofit has maintained that all eligible students with disabilities who were renewing their voucher received funding. 2 years since the expansion, Gates said,
we're hearing about it in our Senate office a whole lot more. This problem is not getting better as it's getting older. It's getting worse as it's getting older.
He supported a Senate bill this year that aimed to solve some of the more common problems affecting voucher families. It failed in the House of Representatives. For example, the proposal would have made it easier to track thousands of kids moving back and forth between public and private schools. The voucher payment schedule and the limited application window are also problematic, Gates said.
We're talking here about over $4 billion in taxpayer money that's going into the scholarship programs. We ought to have decent oversight to make sure that all of those dollars go to the right people in the right place at the right time, because that's not, unfortunately, it's not what's happening now. That's unconscionable, it's wrong, and it's avoidable. We need to make sure the dollars follow the student.
Representatives from the State Department of Education declined an interview and did not respond to my questions. Private school leaders have also been affected by the hasty expansion. In April, a dozen of them filed a legal demand letter to DOE and Step Up for Students, pleading for the release of delayed and missing funds.
Good job, William.
Hey, buddy. How's my boy? You want a hug?
Maria Preston is the owner and clinical director of Diverse Ability Center in Broward County. She's one of the school leaders who joined the letter.
The parents are scared. They're scared they're going to lose their funding. I have parents come in here every day crying. Every, probably 3-4 days a week, they're crying. Either they can't afford something.
The funding headaches for Preston started in September 2023, just months after the state expanded voucher access. She said delays from that time are still affecting her today.
This has been a battle for years.
Angela Seaton is also joining the letter. She owns Square Pegs Learning Center in Panama City. She withdrew hundreds of thousands of dollars from her retirement savings to keep the school going.
It's just unfortunate that we aren't able to do our jobs because we're busy chasing down nickels and dimes to make ends meet.
Step Up for Students is pushing back against the school's claims. The nonprofit and school leaders are trying to find a resolution in hopes of avoiding a lawsuit. I'm Natalie LaRoche-Pietri in Broward County.
Still to come on Capitol Report. Doctors are raising concerns as State Surgeon General Joseph Latipo and Governor Ron DeSantis say they want to remove state childhood vaccine requirements.
If you look back when I was growing up, what they would recommend now, they're recommending like way more stuff.
As hot summer temperatures continue, health professionals are warning about the impacts of extreme heat and heat stroke.
Your proteins of your brain start to gel and break down. The cells of your body start to break down. Your muscles of your body start to break down.
And the Holocaust Museum in downtown St. Petersburg has reopened with what some hope will be lasting lessons. Polio, mumps, and whooping cough. Florida kids have to be vaccinated against those diseases before they can attend a school. But that rule could change. State Surgeon General Joseph Latipo says he wants to end all vaccine mandates in Florida. The health department can roll back some requirements on its own, but dropping school vaccines requires action from state lawmakers. On the Florida Roundup, WLRN's Tom Hudson spoke about what this push could mean for Florida families with Dr. Jason Goldman, a Broward County primary care physician and president of the American College of Physicians.
Vaccines have been the single greatest advancement in modern medicine to help prevent disease, prevent death, prevent hospitalization. This is how we stop diseases and keep people healthy and live long, healthy lives.
Dr. Goldman, the governor talked about this when he endorsed the idea, and he talked about kind of the number of vaccines that children are recommended to get now compared to when he was a kid.
You know, if you look back when I was growing up, what they would recommend now, they're recommending like way more stuff.
Is that true, first of all? And if so, why? What does that tell us?
So, yes, we do have more vaccines because it's called modern medicine and advancement. And we learn more, fight more diseases, combat more diseases, and are able to keep people healthier. So just because there are more vaccines, that means we're getting smarter and able to prevent more diseases that didn't exist before.
Are you satisfied, though, with the science of maybe the interactivity between all of these vaccinations in young children, infants even?
This has been studied multiple times, co-administration, timing of vaccines. It is safe and effective to give multiple vaccines together. It does not cause increased harm. That's been looked at, studied, and proven to be of safe and effective benefit.
Let me move away from the medicine, if I may, doctor, to the business side of this. If childhood vaccinations become 100% optional in Florida, what could that mean for the supply for parents who do want to immunize their children?
Well, it's also a bigger issue that we live in an ecosystem. We are all interconnected. You know, vaccines, not only do they prevent disease, but they keep us healthier. But the real issue is if you get sick with a vaccine-preventable disease, end up in the hospital, you're increasing cost to the system. You're decreasing access of care for others who may need that hospitalization because you're taking up a bed that could have been used for other services. And you are expanding the cost of the entire system. You know, the access to care issue is more of an insurance and payment issue, because if they're not recommended by the advisory committee, then insurances aren't mandated to cover them. And the Vaccine for Children program, which provides vaccines to millions of children who can't afford it, will be affected as well. So it doesn't just affect the individual, it infects the country as a whole.
So does it How does it affect the supply of vaccines?
Well, if there isn't an ability to pay for them, if the manufacturers don't supply them, it's going to decrease access. And that's going to hurt those who want to get vaccines and need those vaccines.
You are a liaison to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices,
yes,
to the CDC. That committee, all of its members were fired by the Health and Human Services Secretary, Secretary Kennedy, back in June. He has appointed, I believe, 7 of the 14 members and has a slate of 7 more. Are you still working with the reconstructed committee today?
It's hard to say. We're liaisons, but we were removed from all of the working groups. So they have essentially removed all the subject matter experts who are there at the meetings to be able to give that real world experience in data analysis, and they removed all of us from the work group. So the question is, who's actually advising the advisors? Who is providing the information? It's certainly not the physicians with the most expertise in this matter.
Am I correct to hear you say that at least on paper, you're a liaison still to this committee, but in reality, you're not?
We have no idea. They're not communicating with us. They're not giving us information. It's not like it was in the past where it was full and transparent and we had access to all the information. Mm. Now it's a dark cloud and we have no idea what's going on.
That was WLRN's Tom Hudson speaking with President of the American College of Physicians, Dr. Jason Goldman. In these dog days of summer in Florida, the heat continues to rise. This means that children, seniors, and people who work outdoors can be subjected to temperatures that can lead to heat-related health risks. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, extreme heat causes more deaths each year than hurricanes, lightning, tornadoes, earthquakes, and floods combined. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford reports on how understanding the heat could be crucial to saving your life.
On a sweltering August day in Southwest Florida, 32-year-old Marco Antonio Hernandez Guevara collapsed working in a farm field. The husband and father of three girls was taken to a Naples hospital and placed on life support. He died several days later. Speaking through an interpreter, Marco's wife says she believes working in the heat caused his tragic death.
I lost my partner. My daughters lost their father. And it's a sorrow that will remain in the family.
A recent report by the CDC states hot weather contributes to or causes the deaths of more than 1,200 people every year. Cape Coral Emergency Room Dr. Timothy Dougherty explains how heat can turn deadly.
There was an old commercial when we grew up.
This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs.
And they would drop an egg onto a frying pan. That is what happens with heat stroke. Your brain is full of protein. At 105 degrees, your proteins of your brain start to gel and break down. The cells of your body start to break down. Your muscles of your body start to break down. That all gets into your bloodstream. That clogs the kidneys. So you can end up with liver failure. You can end up with kidney failure in addition to strokes.
Dr. Dougherty says the spectrum of heat illness begins with mild impacts.
It starts with like heat cramps. So you get a side splint if you're running and you just rest, drink some Gatorade, you're fine. Then there's heat exhaustion. Now you're getting lightheaded, now you're getting weak because of the orthostatic blood pressure goes down and you pass out. Nausea, vomiting usually is involved. Those patients, sometimes they can be treated at home just with Gatorade, but many times they come to the emergency department and we start an IV.
He says the extreme end of heat illness spectrum is heat stroke, classified in two categories.
The first type is the classic heat stroke. That's the heat stroke that normally little kids get or the elderly get. They come in because they either are too young and their body hasn't developed a way to dissipate heat, or they're elderly and there are medications that prevent them from doing so. They usually aren't sweating. They're confused, again, coma, seizure. They're the ones who are greater risk of dying.
Dr. Dougherty says the second kind of heat stroke is exertional or exercise induced.
They come in profusely sweating, mental status change, seizures. They're the firefighters that are creating more heat than their body can dissipate in a very short period of time. We also see that in laborers up on the roof, high schoolers playing football with all their athletic gear on, but that also comes potentially with significant risk of death. But you can usually treat them very quickly.
Concerned about how extreme heat impacts firefighters, the Bonita Springs Fire Department implemented a new heat policy.
When the heat index reaches 110, we stop all outside training for that time.
Chief Greg DeWitt says they receive alerts, similar to lightning alerts, to their phones when the heat index hits 110.
It's all about firefighter health and safety, so we need to be there for the public. So above 110, it makes the firefighters, especially in their gear, more susceptible to heat cramps, heat exhaustion, heat stroke.
On the day Marco passed out working in the field, the heat index in the area hit 112. Health and public safety experts hope that by increasing awareness of the impacts of extreme heat on health, more protections can be put in place and fewer lives lost. I'm Jennifer Crawford reporting.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, the Florida Holocaust Museum in downtown St. Petersburg has reopened following an $8 million renovation. WUSF's Steve Newborn takes us on a tour of some of the artifacts from one of the darkest chapters in history.
Turn a corner at the museum and you'll come face to face with a railway car. The worn-out cattle car looks barely fit for animals. It's like one of the cars that rolled tens of thousands of innocent people to their deaths in the Nazi concentration camps. The wooden boxcar has no windows and the sliding door is closed, like those that sealed the fate of millions of people 80 years ago.
The door is closed because our survivors found it very disturbing to see it open, because obviously for us it's an artifact, for them it was reality. So out of respect for them, we keep the door closed.
Ursula Shapinska directs education and research at the museum. One of the artifacts on display for the first time is equally hard to miss. Just inside the lobby sits a 10-ton Danish fishing boat called Thor. It was part of a flotilla that secretly evacuated almost all the Jews of Denmark to safety in neutral Sweden. Shapinska says it shows that there were some righteous people who fought to stem the Nazi tide.
It was actually still in Denmark as a regular boat. It still belonged to the same family as in 1943, and we were very fortunate to be able to locate it.
A melancholy song performed on one of the violins of hope sets the mood in one section of the museum. It was one of the instruments that were rescued at the end of World War II. The museum has been completely renovated for the first time since it opened in 1998. The third floor will soon display the personal items of Elie Wiesel, whose most famous books were based on his imprisonment at Auschwitz and Buchenwald during the Holocaust. When the museum first opened, there were enough local Holocaust survivors to meet personally with students who toured, but now their numbers are dwindling. So family photographs, school records, even a blouse worn by one of the survivors create a personal touch.
Many of them are gone, but their legacy lives on through the story of the artifacts. Every artifact has a biography of its own, and we can use it as an educational tool.
There's an old saying, one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. So the museum puts an individual face on crimes of an unimaginable scale.
We want to use this core exhibition to show people that these were individual human lives, right? One plus one plus one. Not the anonymous 6 million, but actually individual people who were impacted by this history.
One of the survivors lives on in a new interactive video display. Before she passed away, Tampa Bay area resident Betty Grabenchikoff sat down for a series of interviews. You can ask her a question, and Betty, who found refuge during the war in Shanghai, China, comes to life.
It was exceedingly crowded, and it was always noisy. But we did the best we could over there, and we were lucky we didn't live in one of the settlement camps where a lot of people had to live.
An unfortunate truth is that genocide and mass murder are not just history. Some say it's even happening today. So what do they hope people will walk away with here? Marketing director Melissa Allen wants to keep history from being repeated.
We would like to lean on those lessons of the Holocaust to help try to learn from it and to inch even closer and closer to making never again actual truth.
I'm Steve Newborn in St. Petersburg.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Tristan Wood, Gina Jordan, and Margie Menzel. Thanks also to Natalie LaRoche-Pietri, Tom Hudson, Jennifer Crawford, and Steve Newborn. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. Join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.